Thanks for tuning in for the February 17th podcast. I'm Stacey Clardy, your neurology podcast editor. In this week's featured interview, Dr. Jérôme Honorat is discussing the clinical, biological, and imaging features of a French cohort of patients with glial fibrillary acidic protein, or GFAP, autoantibodies. This is Stacey Clardy, and today I'm speaking with Jérôme Honorat. He is the head of the neuro-oncology department of Lyon's hospital and director of the French Rare Disease Reference Center. We're speaking about his paper, Glial Fibrillary Acidic Protein Autoimmunity, a French cohort study. It's available in the journal Neurology. Jérôme, in this project, you describe the features of a modern French cohort of 46 patients from between 2017 and 2020, so quite recent, with glial fibrillar acidic protein autoantibodies, GFAP, as we call them for short, detected in the cerebrospinal fluid and followed for a minimum of 6 months. Now, this is a fairly large group compared to some other published cohorts. So what do we learn from your cohort and how does it compare to what's been reported in GFAP autoimmunity so far?
Thanks, Stacey. So yes, it's the second largest cohort in the world. And the differences with the other cohorts is that all our patients were positive for GFAP antibodies in the CSF, and only few of them were positive in the serum. And so it seems to be clear that it's an autoimmune disease with a particular clinical presentation, acute meningoencephalitis, frequent involvement of the brainstem, and frequent involvement of myelitis and peripheral nervous system.
So what I'm hearing is cerebrospinal fluid testing maybe allows us to detect a perhaps cleaner phenotype when all the patients are described in terms of having cerebrospinal fluid positivity. And as clinicians, we're looking for a meningoencephalitis, and in many patients, also some accompanying peripheral involvement. Is that right?
Yeah. I think that it's very important to test for the presence of autoantibodies, the CSF, and the series of patients that have been diagnosed only in the serum are more heterogeneous, and we cannot really conclude that there is a relationship with the neurological disease. It's not the case for all the autoantibodies. For example, you may have some patients with LG1 encephalitis who are only positive in the serum, but it's not the case for GFAP.
It's an important point you make, you know, and often when talking to my colleagues and they're saying, hey, I can't memorize all these autoantibodies, which certainly is a bit of a task, and we shouldn't necessarily be expected to have them all memorized. But the point you make about cerebrospinal fluid, it is one that's really relevant across the board. Yes, some of our assays are more sensitive in serum, like LGI1, but as a general approach, I'm not sure what you do, but I tend to collect serum and CSF on anyone where I suspect the possibility of this diagnosis. Do you agree with that approach?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's very important to test both and to conclude only with the results of the test and the clinical presentation of the patient.
With that in mind, and getting back to your paper, you also noted that 61% of the patients, so 28 of them, had coexisting autoimmunity outside the nervous system. Can you tell us the specifics here? What were those other autoimmune conditions?
We observed among our series 10 patients with other autoimmune diseases, such as psoriasis, thyroiditis, ulcerative colitis, alopecia areata, inflammatory rheumatism. And so it demonstrates that these patients are susceptible for autoimmune diseases. And we also observed different other autoantibodies, such as MOG IgG antibodies in 2 patients, AQP4 autoantibodies in 1, and other non-neural autoantibodies, such as antinuclear, antiphospholipid, antithyroid, or anti-gastric parietal cells autoantibodies. So it's not something that could be used to diagnose the patient, but just to illustrate that these patients are able to develop other autoimmune diseases.
Also, 8 of the patients in your cohort were children. What can you tell us about that subgroup? Anything unique or different about the pediatric patients? And what should make our pediatric colleagues think to test for GFAP?
Yeah, in our series, that's right. We have 8 patients who are children with a median age of 14 years. It was between 6 and 17. We did not observe clear clinical characteristics of these patients, but it's only 8 among 46. So it's difficult to have a clear idea. We need to collect more patients. But it's a clear demonstration that GFAP autoantibodies encephalitis exist in children. And so in an acute clinical presentation of meningitis or meningoencephalitis, pediatricians have to test for GFAP autoantibodies.
Point well taken. We hinted at this a little bit with the coexistent systemic autoimmunity, but you also looked at the HLA typing, right? Did you find anything in terms of HLA genetic susceptibility to inform who might get a GFAP autoantibody syndrome?
Yeah, it was a very interesting question, and we collected the DNA of the patients to look at if GFAP encephalitis was associated to a specific HLA, and we didn't find any association, but it's a small group, and it will be probably interesting to look at for a larger group. But I don't think that the HLA could play a particular role in these patients because it's an autoimmune disease associated with IgG1 autoantibodies. And we tested a lot of different groups of autoimmune encephalitis, and we saw that HLA was associated with patients with IgG4 autoantibodies that are observed in patients with LGA1, Caspar-2, IgLon5 autoantibodies. In this case, there is a specific DR haplotype that are associated with this disease at a high level. For example, DR7 in patients with LGA1 encephalitis is observed in more than 90% of the patients. But clearly, GFAP encephalitis is associated with IgG1, and there is no specific HLA haplotype associated. We are only in the morning of the description of this autoimmune encephalitis, and we need more cases to better describe these patients, and I think that genetic will be highly important because there is many arguments suggesting that not all the people are able to develop GFAP encephalitis, but probably only a small part of the population because of genetic specificities. Why? Because most of them have other autoimmune diseases. They also have many different other autoantibodies directed against other organs. And so it will be very important to collect the DNA of these patients and to study which genes could be involved in the susceptibility of this autoimmune disease.
It's a great point. So the HLA testing was only a small part of the picture, and we really need to dig deeper into the genetics.
Exactly.
In some prior reports, there's this really characteristic MRI imaging finding, and these images sort of stay in our memory when they've been published. It's a linear perivascular pattern of contrast enhancement. It tends to extend radially from the periventricular surface and through the cerebral white matter. But from your work, it seems if we're counting on seeing that pattern, we may miss a lot of these patients. Is that right?
Yeah. It was highly surprising and different than the first description of the patients with GFAP encephalomyelitis. We observed perivascular radial gadolinium enhancement in only 12 of 38 patients. So only 33% of the patients. It's clearly this pattern, the contrast enhancement in perivascular radial is very characteristic of patients with GFAP encephalitis, but it's observed in only one third of the patients. And it's very important to look at carefully the MRI because in some patients, you may have other enhancement pattern, periependymal on the cranial nerve in three patients and patchy in one patient. So if you have particular contrast enhancements in an MRI of a patient suspected of autoimmune encephalitis, you have to think about GFAP. But it's not all the patients, and sometimes the MRI can be normal.
This is really important. You know, I think we always love if we know that a finding will be present almost all the time, like say in GABA A encephalitis, but clearly not the case here. It's nice. So if it is there, again, we're probably on the right track to think about GFAP. But also in what you're saying there, some of those findings you're describing are things that we classically associate more with infectious encephalitis. So it's a really important point.
Yeah.
And so tell us overall, once you've made the diagnosis, what were the treatment outcomes and relapse rates like in your cohort? And how has it shaped your current approach to treatment of these patients? What is your preferred regimen now after having studied this group?
The treatment is a very interesting point. And to know if there is recurrences or not is also very important. Our series, the follow-up is too short to have a clear idea of the recurrence. But it seems that GFAP encephalitis is a monophasic disease, and most of the time with improvement and complete improvement of the patients, even if they are hospitalized in ICU. In France, we propose first, in the first line, to use corticosteroids and immunoglobulin, and corticosteroids we soon think that it's better by bolus rather than oral TEP. And in a second line, if it's not efficient, we used anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies such as rituximab to treat these patients. But it's very important to keep in mind that the improvement is very slow. And it's very important to maintain the treatment during a few months before to think that it's inefficient. And the re-education of the patients will be very important because most of them are very severe in the first days of the disease.
Do you have any sense yet, and I know we're just getting to this in all of the autoimmune encephalitis patients, but do you have any sense if cognition is more delayed or if there are some subtle things that take a bit longer to come around?
It's different than NMDA receptor encephalitis because in NMDA receptor encephalitis, the cognitive improvement is very slow, but it's quicker in GFAP encephalitis. The motor and sensitive recruitment of the patients is longer in patients with GFAP encephalitis. And the oculomotor or brainstem involvement, it will be longer to improve for these patients. So the re-education will be probably a little bit different between GFAP and NMDA receptor encephalitis.
And that makes a lot of sense, right? Anytime you have a myelitis component involved or heavily are targeting the brainstem, we know that that's a prolonged neurologic recovery.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you, Jerome. It is always so useful to learn about the newer and emerging neural autoantibodies that allow us, a few at a time, to pluck patients out of these unknown diagnoses categories and into a clear diagnosis. So once again, I've been speaking with Jerome Hanora, director of the French Rare Disease Reference Center, about his paper, Glial Fibrillary Acidic Protein Autoimmunity, a French cohort study that you can read in the journal Neurology. Thank you, Jerome.
Thank you, Stacey.
This is Stacey Clardy again. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll be able to check out the February 8th issue of Neurology. In there is an article examining regional and ethnic differences in stroke incidence among young adults, as well as another study investigating the effect of formaldehyde exposure on cognition. Thanks again for listening. The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.